Chapter 2. The Way to Enlightenment. All human beings are capable of evolving into Buddhas, but one man alone opened the way for the rest of humanity to follow. To be strictly accurate, we should say reopened, because traditionally speaking, there had been other Buddhas, many other pioneers on the path of the higher evolution before him. But when we speak of the Buddha, we refer to Siddhartha Gautama, who discovered the path on the full moon day of the lunar month of April-May in the year 542 BCE. The way he himself put it was this. Suppose a man wandering in a forest wilderness found an ancient path, an ancient trail, travelled by men of old, and he followed it. And by doing so he discovered an ancient city, an ancient royal capital, where men of old had lived, with parks and groves and lakes, walled round and beautiful to see. In such wise have I found the ancient path, the ancient trail, travelled by the fully enlightened ones of old. Hence the very special place in the Buddhist calendar of Vaishakha Purnima, the full moon day of the Indian month Vaishakha. Vaishakha in Pali is Vesakha, and this translates into Sinhalese as Wesak, which gives its name to the most important of Buddhist festivals. At Wesak, Buddhists celebrate what they regard as being the greatest event on record, the occasion when, for the first time in recorded history, an unenlightened being, a man, became an enlightened being, an enlightened man. They commemorate the day when Siddhartha Gautama finally freed himself from all human conditionings, all human limitations, to become, as it were, one with reality, to become even, we may say, a living embodiment of the truth, a Buddha. It might seem surprising, therefore, that there should be a certain amount of confusion as to what is really being celebrated at Wesak. However, whenever I used to be invited to take part in a Wesak celebration in India, whether as a speaker or in some other capacity, what I used to be asked to do was to honour or grace with my presence, such is the Indian style of courtesy in such matters, the thrice sacred day or festival. So why thrice sacred? Surely once is enough. Either something is sacred or it isn't, so you might think. But of course, there is a reason for this designation. According to some sources, the Vaishakha Purnima is the anniversary of not one, but three events. The Buddha's birth, his attainment of enlightenment, and also his final passing away, or parinirvana. They are all supposed to have taken place on the same day, in different years, of course, but by quite a coincidence on the same full moon day. It must be said, however, that this tradition of a thrice sacred Vaishakha Purnima rests on a very late tradition originating in Sri Lanka and then spreading to other Theravada countries. The rest of the Buddhist world, the Mahayana Buddhist countries, celebrate the Buddha's birth and his parinirvana on other days of the year, and this does seem to have been the earlier and also the more reasonable arrangement. As well as having different ideas about whether or not Wesak marks anything besides the Buddha's enlightenment, Buddhists in different parts of the world have different national traditions in the way they go about marking it. In Sri Lanka and Burma, you'll find people lighting candles and offering them in homage to the Buddha's memory. In Tibet, it will be butter lamps, and it will be a particular number of butter lamps, 108 or 1,008 of them. In many Buddhist countries, you will hear people chanting verses in praise of the Buddha, sometimes for hours on end, even all day and all night. In other places there will be lectures and discussions, and some people, of course, will simply be meditating. On a more social level, you will find monks being fed. In some Buddhist countries, this is a very popular pastime on any festive occasion. You gather together as many monks as possible, line them up in rows on the floor, and give them food. Monks are traditionally supposed to have very healthy appetites, and in some Buddhist quarters, the amount of merit you get from feeding a monk is said to be directly linked to the amount of your food the monk eats. In these circumstances, therefore, hospitality is not stinted and certainly not refused. Buddhists in the West follow the lead given by these older traditions, of course, but many of them are in the process of developing their own cultural tradition of celebrating Wesak. At whatever level and in whatever fashion Buddhists celebrate Wesak, they are unified by its one central theme and purpose, which is to rejoice at the emergence of a Buddha in the world. In this, they are following a tradition which goes back a very long way indeed, and we have only to look among the earliest examples of Indian Buddhist stone carvings to find evidence of this. A particularly striking composition places the Buddha in symbolic form on a throne, surrounded by monks, nuns, and lay people, all with their hands joined together above their heads, and all making offerings of garlands, fruits, scarves, all sorts of offerings being made in all sorts of ways. What is really notable about this scene is the expression of absolute joy that all these figures wear, and the joyful way they worship and make offerings to the Buddha. The impression one gets is that an event of overwhelming cosmic importance must have taken place to be celebrated in this exultant and really spectacular manner. It would hardly be an exaggeration to say that the artist has made these worshippers look positively mad with joy, if one can think of Buddhists being really mad about anything. But that seems to be what they are, mad with joy. Such is the only emotional response, as this artist proposes at least, that can do justice to the Buddha's realization of the ultimate possibility of human development. Yet the deep roots of the joy expressed by his followers at Wesak lie not just in the fact that he attained enlightenment for himself, as it were. They lie in the fact that he opened the way, he blazed the trail, for others to follow after him. The question of how the Buddha became enlightened is therefore not just theoretical. Of course, you can approach it theoretically if you wish, as you can approach any question theoretically, but essentially it's a question of the greatest practical importance. The Buddha did not inherit enlightenment. He was not born to be enlightened. He attained enlightenment only after many years of struggle, and even after making mistakes. Through his own efforts, in his own life, he showed how we too, by our own efforts, can gain enlightenment. This provides, in fact, a whole extra line of approach to the Dharma, the way to enlightenment. You can, as already suggested, think of it in terms of evolution, of progressive stages to be followed, like a sort of road, with so many milestones along it, marking the distance you've travelled. And so you have the three great stages of the path, ethics, meditation, and wisdom, as well as many other ways of subdividing and classifying the way to enlightenment. But you can also approach it from a more unusual angle, that is, in terms of the events of the Buddha's life. To contemplate the biographical details of the Buddha's early life is to be concerned not just with the spiritual path followed by a man who lived 2,500 years ago. It is to contemplate a path which one can follow here and now, a path that one is committed to following if one is a Buddhist, if one has Buddhahood as one's ultimate goal. In other words, when, as Buddhists, we celebrate the Buddha's enlightenment, we're not just rejoicing in the things of the past, we're reminding ourselves that it is high time we started to think of our own enlightenment, if indeed we've not already done so, and if we have, to think of it more persistently, more seriously and more deeply. We shall therefore run through the salient events of the Buddha's early life to get a general idea of the way to enlightenment, and then take up, for more detailed examination, certain crucial episodes or features of his biography that have a definite bearing on our own process of development towards enlightenment. Like the story of the Buddha's life as a whole, these particularly notable elements are in substance historical, inasmuch as we know they actually did happen. However, the versions that have come down to us contain a certain amount of legendary material, and it is this legendary material that helps to bring out the universal significance, the inner spiritual dimension, of the external events. The mythical aspect makes it clear, among other things, that these events are concerned not with one man's spiritual career, but with the career of every man and woman who aspires to grow and develop as an individual. It is very often said that Siddhartha Gautama, who became the Buddha, was born in India, and 100 years ago this would have been true. But owing to changing political boundaries, we would have to say today that his birth took place in the southern part of what is now Nepal. He was born into a tribe called the Shakyans, who had inhabited that particular area in the foothills of the Himalayas for many centuries. Nor is it quite true, as it is again often said, that his father, Suddhodana Gautama, was the king of the tribe. He did certainly hold the title of Raja at the time of Siddhartha's birth, but today he would probably be called a president. Like other small tribes in northeastern India at that time, the Shakyans had a semi-republican form of government, with a leader elected from the clan assembly for a fixed period of 12 years. Towards the end of the Buddha's lifetime, the little republics of India were swallowed up by the developing Magadhan Empire, but at the time of his birth, they were for the most part in a flourishing condition. Siddhartha's mother, Maya Devi, was the daughter of the chief of a neighbouring tribe, the Koliyas. It was then the custom, as it still is the custom in many parts of India, for the first child to be born in the house of the mother's parents. When she felt her time approaching, therefore, Maya Devi set off from Kapilavastu, the Shakyan capital, to make for her father's city, carried, as far as we know, in a palanquin. She was still only halfway there when, seized with the pangs of labour, she dismounted, and in a grove of sal trees at a little place called Lumbini, gave birth to the future Buddha. She died shortly afterwards, 7 days later, according to tradition. Siddhartha was reared by his maternal aunt, Maha Prajapati Gotami, whom his father had also married. There is really little more to be said about his childhood. It took place, after all, 2,500 years ago. A single authentic incident stands out from it, one that took place when he was 5, 6, or perhaps 7 years old, on the occasion of the annual ploughing ceremony. In primarily agricultural civilizations all over the world, the sowing of the first seed in the spring was a matter of magical and mythical significance, and the first ploughing was always undertaken by the king or chief. It was one of the duties of the old emperors of China, and until quite recently the emperor of Japan used to inaugurate the ploughing every year. So obviously this was one of the jobs that fell to Siddhartha's father to carry out. Later accounts tell us that it was done with a golden plough, drawn by beautiful white oxen. Storytellers love to embroider their material. But leaving aside the precise quality of the equipment used, what we can say with confidence is that Siddhartha's father performed this ceremony, and that Siddhartha was brought along to watch. The little boy was put on one side on a little bank, in the shade of a jambu or rose apple tree, and it was there that he had what we would describe nowadays as a spontaneous mystical experience. According to the Buddha himself, as he reminisced to his disciples a great many years later, what he experienced beneath the rose apple tree was a sort of superconscious state known as dhyana. So deep was his absorption that he never saw the ploughing at all, and he had still not emerged from the experience when they came to take him home. It is at this point that an interesting legendary anecdote finds its way into the episode. The legend has it that although it was noon when the ploughing started, and evening by the time the ceremony was all over, the shadow of the rose apple tree had not moved during that time. On a literal level, this would be what we call a miracle. But it is perhaps more meaningful if we take it symbolically. The obvious implication is that the sun stood still, and the implication on the symbolic level is that for the young Siddhartha, time itself had stopped. Later on, as we shall see, this experience, or rather the memory of this experience, was to have a crucial bearing on the direction of Siddhartha's spiritual career. But meanwhile, mystical experience or no mystical experience, he was a kshatriya, a warrior, and he would have been brought up like one. That was his caste, the caste of the whole tribe. It was a kshatriya tribe, and so he was literally born a warrior, as others were born Brahmins, priests, Vaishyas, traders and farmers, or Shudras, labourers, just as they are today, although these four castes are now subdivided into some 2,000 subcastes. The future Buddha spent his formative years not in the close study of philosophy and in religious practices, but in the tilt yard, acquiring the arts of archery and spear throwing, sword play, and the skillful handling of a war chariot. With his patrician background, he would have received the best martial training available. He would also have been initiated into the various traditions, customs, beliefs, and superstitions of the tribe, and he would have learnt a little history and genealogy too. Of course, whatever he learnt would have been by word of mouth from the elders of the tribe. It is not in fact clear whether the Buddha ever learnt to read or write. We must imagine him as a man who was cultured, educated and well-bred, without ever having attended anything like a school. It is in any case questionable whether education has really anything to do with going to school. He led on the whole a quite comfortable, well-to-do life, had no particular responsibilities, and was doted on by his father. Siddhartha's upbringing was not, however, quite so simple and straightforward as all that. Shortly after his birth, his father had taken him to a rishi, the sage Asita, to have his horoscope cast. This was common practice, as it still is in India today. There is hardly anybody, even among the westernized so-called elite, who does not have this done for their children, especially for their sons. You want to know what is going to happen to your child, what sort of a career he or she will have, and so you go to an astrologer. It is not known exactly how Siddhartha's horoscope was cast, but we know that he was placed in the arms of Asita, and that the rishi made his calculations. He predicted that the child would have a remarkable future. Siddhartha would either become a great kshatriya, a great warrior and ruler, or else he would give it all up and become a great spiritual master. Suddhodana was deeply disturbed at this prognostication, of course. He liked the idea of his son becoming an illustrious conqueror. He liked it very much. But he was appalled at the idea that the lad might take it into his head to retire from the world altogether and devote his talents to the spiritual quest. The older Siddhartha grew, the more should Adana turn the matter over in his mind. He thought, I want him to grow up like me. I want him to be brave and strong, and extend the territory of the tribe, and, if the Rishi is right, to become a great ruler, and maybe conquer all of India. He must not be allowed to waste his time over all this religious nonsense. Therefore, he must be prevented from thinking too deeply about anything. He must not be introduced to the more unpalatable facts of life, at least not too early. His heart must be set firmly on worldly things. So Suddhodana was determined that the young prince should want for nothing, that all he should learn about life should be how to enjoy it to the most refined pitch of sensual pleasure. The Buddha later related in one of his autobiographical discourses how his father had provided him with 3 beautiful mansions, one for each season, so that he should never feel discomfort from the heat, or the cold, or the rains. And he recounted also how these mansions were filled with alluring dancing girls and bewitching singing girls, and how his days and nights were spent in drinking, dancing and singing, one pleasure succeeding another, with hardly a moment for sadness. At 16 he was married off to a cousin, Yashodhara. It was an arranged marriage, of course, just as in India today a marriage is nearly always negotiated by the families of the bride and bridegroom rather than the young people themselves. He settled down happily enough, and in this way, for many years, his life went on. All the same, though, he seems to have had an underlying sense of dissatisfaction with the life he was leading. He chafed at the bit. When the news was brought to him that his wife had given birth to a son, his reaction was not the usual one of a proud father. Asked what the boy should be called, he said, "A fetter has been born to me. Call him Rahula, for this is what the name Rahula means, a fetter." It was as if he sensed what his father had been trying to do all his life. Somehow, he knew that Suddhodana was trying to bind him down with pleasure, bind him down with property, bind him down with power, with family, with wife and child. He knew what was happening. He neglected his martial exercises and lost interest in the amusements and distractions laid on for him indoors. Domestic life held no joy for him. Increasingly, he took himself off for long periods in order to think. And at some point, he evidently had some sort of spiritual crisis, though this is not, of course, how the early scriptures put it. This psychological and spiritual turning point is known among Buddhists everywhere in the form of a dramatic narrative called the Four Sights. Whether this is a legend, whether it is an external projection of an experience arising out of intense inner questioning, or whether it actually happened in something like the way the story has come down to us, it is impossible for us to say for sure. What is certain is that the Four Sights crystallize in a very powerful form some of the fundamental teachings of Buddhism, as well as throwing light on the Buddha's own early spiritual development. The story goes that one bright morning Siddhartha called his charioteer to harness the horses for an outing. "Let's see what's going on in the world, see what people are up to," he said. The charioteer shook his head. "I'm afraid we can't do that. It's more than my job's worth. You know the king has said you're not to go out among the people." But the young prince insisted, "Don't worry, I'll take full responsibility. If the king has anything to say about it, let him say it to me. But let's go." So the horses were whipped up and away they went. They drove out into the village, and Siddhartha saw life going on as much as he might have expected, until his attention was arrested by the sight of a very old man. The traditional accounts give a graphic description of this old man's appearance. Feeble, withered and bent over, his bones sticking out, tottering along on a stick. He had a long white beard, and the rheum was trickling from his eyes. If this seems to be laying it on a bit thick, it would not seem so in India. There, old people, even today, because of the climate and the hard life, can look very old indeed. At no more than 50 or 60, they can look about 100 years old. We have to remember that, according to the legend, his father had deliberately secluded him from anything unpleasant about life, and this included old age. So when Siddhartha saw this very old man, he pointed at him and said, "Who, what is that?" The charioteer thought, "Well, he'll have to find out sooner or later," and he said, "It's an old man." "But why is he like that? Why is he so bent? Why do all his bones stick out? Why is that fluid trickling out from his eyes?" The charioteer was not used to fielding this sort of question, except perhaps from children. He said simply, "Well, he's just an old man." Obviously, Siddhartha was not satisfied by this, but how has he got like that? "It just happens," the charioteer explained gently. "You don't have to do anything to get old. You just get old. It's natural. I'm afraid everybody gets old." The young prince felt his flesh creep. "What, everybody?" he asked. And the charioteer said, "Well, yes, of course, everybody." "What about me? Will I become like that?" The charioteer nodded. "The king, your father, the queen, your mother, your wife, myself, and you too, all of us, are subject to old age." We are told that Siddhartha received this intelligence like an elephant struck by a thunderbolt, and he broke into a cold sweat with the shock. "What is the use of being young?" he lamented. "What is the use of this vitality and strength, if it all ends in such emaciation and frailty?" He was sick at heart. "That's enough for today, I think. Let's go home," he said. And as they rattled back to the palace, he brooded over the knowledge he'd been given. This, then, is the legend of the first sight. Siddhartha may or may not have literally clapped eyes on an old man for the first time in this way, but there is no mistaking the real significance of it. He might have seen, perhaps, many old men before, but somehow missed really seeing them. That day, perhaps, he saw an old man as though for the first time. This is the way it goes, of course. We see a thing. We see it maybe every day of our lives, just as we see the sun rising and the sun setting. But we don't really see it because we're not aware and we don't think. We see, but we don't see. We are blind. One might work in an old people's home for years without taking in the fact of old age to any great depth. Then, when we develop some awareness, some clarity, we can find that things appear to us in such a fresh light that it is as if we never saw them before. So Siddhartha realized, truly realized for the first time in his life, that there was such a thing as old age, and that youth would be brief, even for him. Shaken as he was by this realization, Siddhartha went out again a few days later, so the legend has it, and again he saw something he'd never seen before. What he saw was a sick man, lying by the roadside, with an attack of fever, or something of that sort, tossing this way and that, with no one to care for him. Again Siddhartha asked the charioteer to explain to him what was going on. "Tell me what has happened to this man. What is wrong with him? Why is he lying there beside the road? Why is he twitching? Why is he shaking and shivering? Why are his eyes rolling so wildly? Why does his face look so ghastly?" And of course the charioteer had to tell him, "Well, he's ill." And Siddhartha, who had apparently enjoyed blooming health up to that time, wanted to know whether he too would be likely to suffer in this way. "Does this happen to other people? Will it happen to me?" So again the charioteer drove the point home. All men, all women are liable to sickness. It might come at any time. At any moment strength and health may go from us, and then we must suffer sickness. So again Siddhartha had something to ponder over as he returned to the palace. But after a few days, off they went once more in the chariot, and this time he saw four men coming towards them, carrying something between them on a sort of stretcher, the poles of which were balanced on their shoulders. Lying on the stretcher there was a man wrapped in a yellow sheet. His face was exposed, but there was something odd about it. He didn't move a muscle. The face was quite expressionless, stiff-looking, and the eyes were closed. Of course you can still see this sight any day of the week in India. An Indian funeral is rather different from what most of us are used to in the West. Here, when you die, you're smuggled away in a box, and that's that. You are just quietly disposed of, like so much garbage that no one wants to look at. You're put into the incinerator or into a little hole in the ground and covered over. But in India, it isn't like that. In India, you are laid out in the best room of the house, and all your friends and relations come round to have a good look and say, "Ah, it looks just like him. It's old so-and-so to the life. Well, he looks quite happy, quite peaceful. Yes, goodbye then, old fellow." They shed a tear and throw a few flowers on the corpse, and then it is hoisted on the shoulders of four strong men and borne through the streets with the face still uncovered. So the corpse is jolting along, crowds of people following behind in the heat, and the people passing by look and say, "Oh yes, there's old so-and-so. Didn't know he'd died." This sort of procession is what Siddhartha saw, and he said to the charioteer, "That's very strange. Why are they carrying that man like that? What are they doing? What's he done?" The charioteer replied in his usual laconic style, "Well, this is a dead body." We have to remember, of course, that death was one of those matters Siddhartha was supposed to have been kept in the dark about, so he was mystified by this explanation. "Dead? What do you mean, dead?" And the charioteer again had to expatiate a little. "Well, you can see he's stiff, lifeless, doesn't breathe, doesn't see, doesn't hear, doesn't feel. He's dead. They are taking him to the burning ground. They are going to burn the body. It's what happens at death." Siddhartha gasped with horror. "Does this, too, happen to everybody? Will everybody come to this death, as you call it? Will I, too, come to death?" The charioteer drew a long sigh. "Yes, your father, your mother, your wife, your child, they must all die one day. I must die, you must die. Everybody who is born must die. There have been millions of men and women born since the world began, and every single one of them has died. No doubt there will be millions more born in the future, but every single one of them will die. No one can ever escape the cold hand of death. Death is king of all." So, more sad, more thoughtful, more anguished than ever, Siddhartha ordered the charioteer to turn round and head back to the palace. Over these three outings with his charioteer, he had come up against what nowadays might be called ineluctable existential situations, facts of existence from which you can't escape. You don't want to grow old, but you can't help it. You don't want to fall sick, but it happens. You don't want to die, but die you will, like it or not. So you start asking yourself questions. How do I come to be in this condition? I want to go on living forever, young and strong and healthy, but it isn't going to be that way. How is it that I've been given this urge to live when I'm given not the remotest chance of escaping death? It's a riddle. But why am I presented with this riddle at all? Why this mystery? Is it God who is responsible? Is it fate? Or is this just the way it is? Is there an explanation? Or is there no explanation? Siddhartha was wrestling with the fundamental questions of life and death in this way when he took in the last of the four sights. Riding out again in his chariot, he saw a man dressed not in the usual white garb, but in a yellow robe and shaven-headed. This man was walking calmly along the village street with a begging bowl, going from door to door. There was something in his mindful gait that Siddhartha found quietly compelling, and he asked the charioteer, "What manner of man is this that looks so at peace with himself and the world?" The charioteer replied, "This is one who has gone forth." "Gone forth?" said Siddhartha. "Gone forth from what?" "From the world," the charioteer explained. "Gone forth from his home, gone forth from family. He has simply left it all behind to devote himself to the search for truth. He's trying to find an answer to the riddle of existence. To do this, he's given up all worldly ties, all domestic responsibilities, all social and political obligations. In this way, he has gone forth." You may find such people in India even today, still wearing the saffron robe. They are called sadhus, which simply means good people, and supporting them with alms is considered very meritorious. People give them food, invite them into their homes, and look after them. Very much the same system is still in operation after 2,500 years. And it was the sight of just such a figure that awoke in the young Siddhartha the inspiration to go forth himself. The ultimately unacceptable limitations of human life had impressed themselves upon his consciousness too forcibly for him to be able to ignore them, to put them aside and just get on with his life. You can choose not to see them, but they are there all the time, and he knew this. But now he knew also that there was a way of penetrating through to the meaning of it all. After spending a long time thinking things over, he decided that there was nothing for it but to become a sadhu himself. He felt that these questions had to be answered, and that he could not rest until an answer was found. So, one full moon night, when everything was quiet, Siddhartha bade a last farewell to his sleeping wife and child. He was not happy to leave them, but there could be no alternative. He had told no one about his decision, except his faithful charioteer, who saddled the horse for him to ride out of the palace as a prince for the last time. We are told that the charioteer seized hold of the horse's tail and trotted behind, and that they travelled as far as a river marking the border of the Shakyan territory. There Siddhartha cut off his beard and his long flowing black hair. Just then, it was the crack of dawn, a beggar came along, and Siddhartha offered to swap clothes with him. It did not take the beggar long to agree to this proposal, eccentric as it seemed, and he went on his way, blinking with delight at the richly embroidered robes he now wore, the gold and silver buttons and buckles on them gleaming in the first rays of the sun. Siddhartha made his farewells to his faithful charioteer and his faithful horse and watched them go. Then he plunged on into the jungle alone. He went in search of teachers who he hoped might have penetrated to the ultimate mystery of existence. In those days in India, much as in India today, there were many who illumined the ways to the attainment of truth. He went from one teacher to another. He practiced according to their instructions and mastered what they had to teach. But he was not satisfied. Good and profound as their teachings were, he knew that there was something beyond all they knew, something beyond all they had realized. He had no name for it. He did not know what it was, but he had to find it. He had to know it. He had to carry on his search. He was grateful for all that he had learned, but he moved on. he began a program of terrible austerities. This was a common practice in India, as it still is today, for it was thought that the thinner the veil of the flesh, as it were, the more transparent it was to the light of the spirit. For years Siddhartha mortified the flesh, and no one in India exceeded him in self-torture. The fame of his austerities was noised abroad, so it is said, like the sound of a great bell hung in the canopy of the sky, and he began to gather followers of his own. Eventually, however, something happened to make him wonder if he wasn't making a great deal of progress in the wrong direction. He fainted and collapsed into a river, from which, not having the strength to save himself, he was fortunate to be rescued. When he recovered, he said to himself, "This is ridiculous. I'm getting no nearer to the truth for all this asceticism. I've been wasting my time. It's all been a big mistake." So Siddhartha Gautama, the great ascetic, started taking regular meals again. His five disciples were not at all impressed. The fact was that they were not so much disciples as admirers, hangers-on. They relied on him to make the effort and just hung on to his coattails in the hope that his achievements would somehow rub off on them. They thought that when he achieved his goal by virtue of his austerities, they would be the first to benefit. So it was obviously a great disappointment to them when he made the decision to give his body the nourishment it needed. "He's backsliding," they said to one another. "He's gone back to the luxurious ways of the world. Clearly he's not the man we thought he was." And they trooped off in disgust. Once again Siddhartha was on his own. It was 6 years after he had left the palace when he came to the place that would mark the end of his quest. At a spot in the present-day state of Bihar, called Uruvela, now known as Buddha Gaya, he found a copse of beautiful trees beside a river. It seemed an ideal location in which to sit and meditate. Then, as he sat there in the shade, with a cool breeze blowing, he remembered something that suddenly seemed to show the way forward. He recollected his experience of 30 years before, sitting beneath another tree, while his father initiated the season's ploughing. He gently felt his way back to that integrated state of concentration, not trying to force it, but just letting it come, and letting go of whatever hindered its arising. As he did so, a cowherd's wife from a neighbouring village brought him some milk rice, which he took, and he was nourished and strengthened by it. A grass cutter also came up to provide him with a heap of kusa grass to sit on, and he made himself comfortable on it. Then he settled down and gave himself to his meditative experience. He plunged deeper and deeper into it, through level after level of superconscious states. How long he sat there we do not know. It may have been days, it may have been weeks, it may even have been months. All that we do know is that on the night of Vaishakha Purnima, he saw the solution to the problem upon which his mind had been bent ever since the four sights had awakened him to it. He not only saw this solution, but understood it, plunged into it, became one with it, and realized it. Full illumination arose within him, and he became enlightened. Some of the early texts try to give us some idea of the content of that experience, but this is by no means an easy thing to attempt. Enlightenment is inherently ineffable. It is not to be circumscribed by the rational mind. However, to begin with, we can say that it is a state of pure, clear, radiant awareness. And it is sometimes specified that in this state of awareness, one no longer makes any emotional distinction between oneself and others. That sense we have of an inner world set against the world outside ourselves, is entirely transcended. There is just one continuous, pure, and homogeneous awareness, extending freely in all directions. It is, moreover, an awareness of things as they really are. This means an awareness of things not as objects, but as transcending the duality of subject and object. Hence, this pure, clear awareness is also spoken of as an awareness of reality. It is a state of knowledge. Knowledge not in the ordinary sense of someone accumulating notions of things, but rather a seeing of things directly and truly, unmediated by any separate subject doing the seeing. It is a spiritual vision, even a transcendental vision, which is free from all delusion, all misconception, all wrong crooked thinking, all vagueness, all obscurity, all mental conditioning, and all prejudice. However, this is not the end of it. Enlightenment can be described as full illumination, as transcendental awareness, as wisdom. But it is also an overflowing of profound love and compassion for all that lives. It is described too as supreme bliss, or complete emancipation, the bliss of release from this subjective ills and limitations of conditioned existence. It is thus also characterized by the inexhaustible energy continually bubbling forth, total spontaneity, uninterrupted creativity. At the same time, none of these aspects of enlightenment function separately from one another. Therefore, the actual experience cannot be described at all. Only by reflection on the Dharma, reflecting on the Buddha's teaching, as well as on his example, by deep communication with friends, and above all by meditation, can we get some real intimation of what the enlightenment of a Buddha consists in. The traditional accounts say that the Buddha's enlightenment arose or blossomed gradually as the full moon night of Wesak wore on. According to one account, in the first watch of the night the Buddha looked back into the past, into the dark, backward and abysm of time. He looked back over the whole course of human history, over millions of years of evolution. We are told that he was able to survey all his previous lives and see what he had done and what had arisen in consequence of his actions. He saw the conditions he'd laid down and the results that had followed from them. And he saw that it was all done with, all ended. He had transcended the whole process of conditioned existence. Then in the second watch of the night he looked, as it were, all around him, all around the universe, and he saw beings of every kind, human beings, animals, even beings in higher worlds. He saw how each one came into being, became what it was, in accordance with what it had done, in other words, how beings were reborn according to their karma. He saw this happening at every level of mundane existence, from the deepest abyss of the hell realms to the highest sphere of the gods. Finally, in the third watch of the night, he directed his mind to the destruction of the ashravas, literally biases. The ashravas are the natural biases of the mind, the deep-rooted tendency of the mind towards conditioned existence, rather than that towards that which is unconditioned, towards unreality rather than towards reality. There are three ashravas: the bias or inclination of the mind towards sensuous experience, the bias towards existence as a separate ego-centered personality, and the bias towards spiritual ignorance, that is, ignorance of reality. So he turned his mind, in the purity of its concentration, to the elimination of the ashravas, and in the morning when the sun rose, he knew that for him the ashravas had been destroyed completely. Enlightenment had been attained. Siddhartha Gautama had become the Buddha.